The chapter which of the Bible which we'll be reading today, Numbers 16, is the story of Korah's rebellion, and it's the story of a tragedy. In fact, Numbers chapter 16 is one of the great tragedies of the Bible. It's a disturbing story, not only because it contains a horrifying number of deaths and includes some very graphic scenes, but also because the brutal deaths are the work of God. It's really tempting to skip over this chapter and move on to something less disturbing. But if we did that, we would miss something important. So, deep breath, as we're going in, and David will read us Numbers chapter 16.
Right, and if you'd like to read along with me, that's on page 153 in the Church Bible. Korah, son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and certain Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, became insolent and rose up against Moses. With them were 250 Israelite men, well-known community leaders who had been appointed members of the council. They came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly?" When Moses heard this, he fell face down. Then he said to Korah and all his followers, "In the morning the Lord will show who belongs to him and who is holy, and he will make that person come near him. The man he chooses he will cause to come near him. You, Korah, and all your followers are to do this. Take censers, and tomorrow put fire and incense in them before the Lord. The man the Lord chooses will be the one who is holy. You Levites have gone too far." Moses also said to Korah, "Now listen, you Levites. Isn't it enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the Israelite community and brought you near himself to do the work at the Lord's tabernacle and to stand before the community and minister to them? He has brought you and all your fellow Levites near himself, but now you are trying to get the priesthood too. It is against the Lord that you and all your followers have banded together. Who is Aaron that you should grumble against him?" Then Moses summoned Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, "We will not come. Isn't it enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the desert? And now you also want to lord it over us? Moreover, you haven't brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey or given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you gouge out the eyes of these men? No, we will not come." Then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not accept their offering. I have not taken so much as a donkey from them, nor have I wronged any of them." Moses said to Korah, "You and all your followers are to appear before the Lord tomorrow, you and they and Aaron. Each man is to take his censer and put incense in it, 250 censers in all, and present it before the Lord. You and Aaron are to present your censers also." So each man took his censer, put fire and incense in it, and stood with Moses and Aaron at the entrance to the tent of gathering. Of meeting. When Korah had gathered all his followers in opposition to them at the entrance to the tent of meeting, the glory of the Lord appeared to the entire assembly. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Separate yourselves from this assembly so that I can put an end to them at once." But Moses and Aaron fell face down and cried out, "O God, God of the spirits of all mankind, will you be angry with the entire assembly when only one man sins?" Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to the assembly, 'Move away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram.'" Moses got up and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. He warned the assembly, "Move back from the tents of these wicked men. Do not touch anything belonging to them, or you will be swept away because of all their sins." So they moved away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Dathan and Abiram had come out and were standing with their wives, children, and little ones at the entrances to their tents. Then Moses said, "This is how you will know that the Lord has sent me to do all these things, and that it was not my idea. If these men die a natural death and experience only what usually happens to men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings about something totally new, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them with everything that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the grave, then you will know that these men have treated the Lord with contempt." As soon as he finished saying all this, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them, with their households, and all Korah's men, and all their possessions. They went down alive into the grave with everything they owned. The earth closed over them, and they perished and were gone from the community. At their cries, all the Israelites around them fled, shouting, "The earth is going to swallow us too." And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, to take the censers out of the smoldering remains and scatter the coals some distance away. For the censers are holy, the censers of the men who sinned at the cost of their lives. Hammer the censers into sheets to overlay the altar, for they were presented before the Lord and have become holy. Let them be a sign to the Israelites." So Eleazar the priest collected the bronze censers brought by those who had been burned up, and he had them hammered out to overlay the altar, as the Lord directed him through Moses. This was to remind the Israelites that no one, except a descendant of Aaron, should come to burn incense before the Lord, or he would become like Korah and his followers. The next day, the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. "You have killed the Lord's people," they said. But when the assembly gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron and turned towards the tent of meeting, suddenly the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Then Moses and Aaron went to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord said to Moses, "Get away from this assembly so that I can put an end to them at once." And they fell face down. Then Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put incense in it, along with fire from the altar, and hurry to the assembly to make atonement for them. Wrath has come out from the Lord. The plague has started." So Aaron did as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. The plague had already started among the people, but Aaron offered the incense and made atonement for them. He stood between the living and the dead, and the plague stopped. But 14,700 people died from the plague, in addition to those who had died because of Korah. Then Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance to the tent of meeting, for the plague had stopped. This is the word of the Lord.
When you first hear this story, you might think that it sounds a bit like the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989, a pro-democracy movement that is brutally crushed. A quick run through. What happened? Verse 1 to 5. They asked for greater freedom. Verse 31 to 35. The movement for freedom is destroyed and the protesters are executed. Then the people flee in panic. In response, God sends a plague. And at the end, 15,000 people are dead. This is one of those stories that makes people think of the God of the Bible as violent, autocratic, and with somewhat arbitrary rules. But if you read the story a bit more carefully, it quickly becomes clear that the first impression is completely wrong. Because this is not a pro-democracy movement. This is a mutiny. This story is traditionally called Korah's Rebellion, but I think the word mutiny, moiterai, is better than rebellion, because in English, rebellion has become a pretty weak word, and it's used casually. I mean, we even talk about rebellious teenagers. That's pretty mild. A mutiny, on the other hand, is far more serious. A mutiny is a conspiracy to openly oppose, change, or overthrow your leadership. The most famous mutinies occurred on sailing ships in the 18th century. When I was a boy, I was interested in the age of sail, and so I read a lot of stories about that time, and that meant that I read a lot about many mutinies. They always follow a pattern. And here's what happens. The ship's crew are generally unhappy. Some of them decide that they're sick of obeying the captain and they're not going to do it anymore. This is usually because they feel the captain is greedy or cruel, or they may think that he's become dangerously insane and they're not going to follow a crazy man. And usually, the crew sees an opportunity for personal gain. Gold, alcohol, or women, the most common. So they make a conspiracy, a secret plan to remove the captain. For a mutiny to be successful, it needs to be supported by most of the crew and led by the most senior and respected officers. Typically, they get the captain and imprison him in his cabin, or throw him overboard, perhaps in a small lifeboat, and a senior member of the crew takes command. Mutinies usually end badly. Normally, several people end up dead. When the Navy learns about the mutiny, the retaliation is severe. Because if they're not stopped, mutinies will spread to other ships. In the British Army, for example, participation in a mutiny was punishable by death until 1998, just 12 years ago. This story of Korah has all the elements of mutiny. There's a conspiracy, an attempt to overthrow the leader by a public show of force, and a devastating end. But at first, it might not sound much like a mutiny. Their initial complaint sounds fairly reasonable. Verse 3. Everyone is holy, they say. Holy means set apart from God, specially chosen by God, for God. They say, the Lord is among us. And they say, why should only one person have access to God? All of us should be able to serve God. And all these things are true. In fact, in the last verses of the previous chapter, the people were told to tie blue bits of string to the corners of all their clothes to remind themselves that they were holy, that they had been specially chosen by God. So what these guys are saying is true. But something is horribly wrong. The first sign that there's something unreasonable about Korah and his friends is that their complaint is so public. Korah doesn't say, Moses, I need to talk to you privately about something quite important. He doesn't do that. Instead, there's a huge crowd. 250 men are involved. And they're all well-known men, well-known community leaders. And remember that the people are living in tents in the desert at the time. And they're probably bored out of their mind. So we can be certain there was lots of people hanging around watching what's going on. Secondly, the fact that there's so many people involved and Moses doesn't know about it indicates that this has been planned for some time. There has been a conspiracy. I don't think they're asking Moses to consider a change in how the community is run. It seems the decision has already been made independently of Moses. They've got so many people involved that he has no choice. He will be forced to change. They are trying to intimidate Moses through force. It's also worth noting that Moses and Aaron are about 80 years old at this point. As the Germans would say, Moses was top fit. But he's still an old guy. And two old blokes against 250, no chance. And thirdly, they begin this aggressively. The first thing they say, you've gone too far. Not a great conversation starter. Why actually do they think Moses has gone too far? Is it the previous chapter, chapter 15, which is all about rules for priests? Or is it the chapter before, chapter 13 and 14, where the people had tried to enter the promised land, had refused to enter the promised land, and were stuck in the desert as a result? Well, it seems to be both. When you look at the whole chapter, you find there's actually two different groups of mutineers. Korah doesn't like the rule that only Aaron's family can be priests. Dathan and Abiram don't like that they're stuck in the desert. And the two groups have made an alliance, a joint mutiny. Well, how does Moses respond to this threat? It's a useful example in seeing how godly leadership should respond to intimidation. His first response, he immediately falls on his face, verse 4. He doesn't respond aggressively. He will not fight them. And he says, we will ask the Lord. Notice he says, the Lord will show, the Lord will choose. It's not my decision. This is quite a contrast to the mutineers who are attempting to tell Moses what to do. Now, he tells them to get censers and put fire and incense in them. This censer that's a weird word, and I don't really know exactly what that means, but as far as I can tell, it's a little bit like this. You have a bowl with a stick on the top, with a rod at the bottom that you hold. And they put burning coals in the top, and they carry that fire to the altar. And that will be a test. That's a thing that priests do. That's how they approach God. Moses says, this is what they're going to do. The man the Lord chooses will be the one who is holy. But then he uses their words back at them. You Levites have gone too far. It's a warning. Moses knows that these guys are taking a big risk. Only Aaron and his sons have been chosen by God to offer sacrifices at the altar. But even for them, it was a dangerous activity. Back in Leviticus 10, Aaron's two oldest sons died when they got it wrong. From the context in that chapter, it seems likely they were drunk at the time. It's dangerous. Nobody in their right mind would want to approach God directly if they could send someone else to do it. They also have 24 hours to change their mind. This doesn't happen immediately. They can change their mind overnight. There is a chance to repent. Moses also says to Korah, Isn't it enough for you that God has separated you? Is it too small a thing that he has given you? It's not even clear why they want this job. Korah's family is one of the most senior of the Levites, the most chosen people in the community. Korah's family's job is to carry the holy items, like the lampstand and the Ark of the Covenant. This is an important job, and it's highly respected. But they are not humble and are not content. Apparently, they think this job is beneath them. They are taking care of the most precious items that the Israelites have, but they act as if that's not important enough. As Moses says in verse 11, it's against the Lord that you and your followers have banded together. Who is Aaron that you should grumble against him? Although this has been presented as a personal complaint against Moses and his brother, they are really grumbling against the Lord. The other half of the mutiny begins in verse 12. The other two ringleaders, Dathan and Abiram, they're from a different tribe, and they don't seem to be interested in taking spiritual leadership. They want something else. They want political leadership. They don't want Aaron's job. They want to replace Moses. They seem to have made an alliance with Korah to knock out both the guys at once. And when Moses requests a meeting with them, the truth comes out. We will not come. They refuse to come up. They are not willing to negotiate. Certainly, they're frustrated by the decades of wandering in the desert. It's possible that they even have some legitimate complaints about Moses' leadership style or aspects of life in the camp, but they're not interested in a peaceful solution. And what they say is unbelievable. Take a look at verse 13. Verse 13 is one of the most outrageous, defiant, and utterly twisted things anyone has ever said. Isn't it enough that you've brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the desert? The land flowing with milk and honey is the promised land. That's where they've been going. But here, they're saying the land flowing with milk and honey is the place they've left. Egypt. Egypt? They were slaves in Egypt. And they weren't just basic slave labourers. The Egyptians were ruthless, whipping them, working them to death. And it's worse. In Egypt, they suffered from attempted genocide. All their male babies were to be thrown in the river. Without God's intervention, the Israelites would not have survived. And they described that death camp as paradise. And then they back that up with a very personal attack on Moses. He's nearly killed them in the desert. He's acting like a greedy prince. Now you also want to lord it over us. And he's a complete failure as a leader. You haven't brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey. You haven't given us an inheritance. No fields, no vineyards. And then there's a really bizarre accusation that he wants to poke their eyes out. You can feel their absolute contempt for Moses as they repeat, "We will not come up. We have nothing to talk about." Really feel for Moses. He complains to God, "This is horribly unfair. I haven't even taken one donkey from them. Not even one lousy donkey." Obviously, their world's a bit different from ours. Is a donkey the smallest thing you could take from somebody? But to understand how unfair this is, let's remember how Moses got this job in the first place. God chose him at the burning bush. And Moses' first response was, "Oh my Lord, please send somebody else." Again, notice how Moses' view of God is completely different to the mutineers. He has never tried to grab a powerful position by force. God chose him, and he obeyed. This is how God's leadership works. It's pretty clear that the mutineers want a change of leadership. If they had been successful, what would they actually have done? Their previous attempt to enter the land of Canaan had failed, and they're obviously sick of being in the desert. So I think that they genuinely planned to lead the people back to Egypt. They had no other option. And if they succeed, they destroy God's salvation plan. The people do not enter the promised land. God now faces a double mutiny. Simultaneously, we've got Korah attacking God's holiness and Dathan and Abiram attacking God's salvation plan. God's response is unambiguous. He makes a proposal of the utmost severity. The people will be destroyed. Only Moses and Aaron will be spared. Verse 21. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Separate yourselves from this assembly so that I can put an end to them at once." And here we have what I like to call a Jesus moment. There's a small number of times in the Bible where somebody is clearly filled with the Holy Spirit and acts in a way which towers above their normal humanity. God has made Moses to be a forerunner of Jesus. Deuteronomy 18 states explicitly that one day God will send a great prophet like Moses. We know that that great prophet was Jesus. Moses here is not just acting by himself. He's also representing Jesus when he says in verse 22, he pleads for the salvation of the people. Will you be angry with the entire assembly when only one man sins? Will you destroy the whole people just because there is one bad man? And God does spare the people. Verse 23, the Lord said to Moses, "Move away from the tents of Korah, Dathan and Abiram." We see God sparing the people often in the Bible. Although God several times threatens to destroy everything, his nature is always to have mercy. There's always something reluctant about God's judgment. But even so, we see in the verses 31 to 34, probably the most savage act of God in the Bible. The ringleaders are swallowed up by the ground. They are never seen again. They went down alive into the grave with everything they owned. The earth closed over them and they perished and were gone from the community. There's a particularly uncomfortable sentence in those chapters, in those verses, because not only the ringleaders die, but their whole families die with them. We've seen some pretty harsh stuff in the book of Numbers already, but this is really extreme. Why? Why is God doing this? I'm almost certain that this is because they wanted to lead the people back to Egypt, the land of slavery, back to the land where Pharaoh had tried to exterminate them by killing all their male children. This is what Dathan and Abiram experience. It's a reminder, an alternative reality, a taste of what they left behind. And God's response, they have been removed from history. They will have no descendants. Not a trace of them is left. They are gone. The immediate reaction of the people is the same as mine would be. They flee in panic. Run for your life. We're all going to die. But then, verse 41, comes the really great tragedy. The people have not learned anything. They have completely missed the point. The next day, they complain, "You have killed the Lord's people." Notice how they blame Moses and not God. And this episode is really tragic. It's hard to imagine how God could have been any clearer. Even with 250 men dead before their eyes, they still don't take God's holiness seriously. They still don't realise how difficult it is to approach God. Even with three men swallowed up by the earth, they don't see how those men were threatening the salvation of them all. They don't realise how close they all came to returning into slavery. Moses was wrong. Moses had told God that only one man had sinned. But it wasn't just one man's mutiny. They had the support of the whole community. And so God said the same thing he'd said before. Get away from this assembly so that I can put an end to them at once. And so the plague comes. At this time, it's Aaron who has a Jesus moment. They intercede again. Aaron offered the incense and made atonement for them. He stood between the living and the dead, and the plague stopped. Unlike the mutineers, whose attempted offering had brought death, Aaron's brings life. Aaron stood between the living and the dead. Like Jesus, this is where death stops. However great the rebellion, however villainous the mutiny, there will be no more death. God will bring his people into the promised land. If the story really ended there, at the end of this chapter, it would be very black indeed. But this story does not end there. After you've agonised about this for a while and begun to reluctantly accept the severity of God's judgment, I hope that you have the courage to keep reading the book of Numbers, and for that matter, the rest of the Bible. Near the end of the book of Numbers, the mutiny is mentioned again. But there's one surprising extra piece of information in Numbers 26, verse 11. But the sons of Korah did not die. What? The line of Korah, however, did not die out. The sons did not die. And then you read this chapter again, more carefully this time. And this time you notice that unlike the other two, Korah didn't drag his family into the mutiny. And his family survived. They are in the list of the people who finally entered the promised land. They entered the land flowing with milk and honey. But there's more to the story. In 1 Chronicles chapter 6, we find that Korah's descendants became musicians in the temple. And they wrote at least 12 of the Psalms. Here at LAC, we often sing songs based on some of them. Psalm 42. As the deer pants for the water, so my soul pants for you, O God. That's by them. Psalm 46. God is our strength and refuge, our present help in trouble, and we therefore will not fear, though the earth gives way. These are songs that that God's people have sung through the ages. Korah's family has been a blessing to very many people. And we know that the story continues past the Psalms. We know that after the long sequence of disasters that we call the Old Testament, God sent his only Son as the once-for-all sacrifice that allows us to approach God. But if we haven't read the gut-wrenching stuff that we find in some of these chapters, we won't really appreciate what we have in the New Testament. Hebrews chapter 10, 26. Therefore, brothers, we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus. Confidence. After this, how can we have confidence to approach God? Yes, we can have confidence. Through the blood of Jesus. And he is the same God. The God in the New Testament is the same as the God in the Old Testament. who was almost completely unapproachable. This is truly extraordinary. We need to know this story because the things that threaten us are the same threats that threatened them. In the New Testament, the letter of Jude warns the readers to beware of false teachers. Verse 11, Jude says that the false teachers walked in the way of Cain and perished in Korah's rebellion. False teaching didn't end with Korah, and it didn't end in Jude's time. Look out for the same elements: an attempt to prove a spiritual truth by intimidation, a secret, real motivation which is totally opposed to the will of God, an opportunity for personal gain, and a coming judgment. False teachers will deny God's holiness. False teaching will try to send us back to slavery. And we are vulnerable as long as we don't feel the importance of God's holiness and God's salvation plan. Although we can learn much about false teaching and godly leadership, this story isn't primarily addressed to our minds. It's not intended to give us information. This story speaks to our emotions. Numbers chapter 26 says that when the fire devoured the mutineers, they became a warning to us, a warning that holiness matters and salvation matters. The Israelites were vulnerable because they did not feel the importance of holiness. They did not feel the importance of salvation. We know not to follow Korah and the other false teachers throughout history in making our own rules for how we approach God. We know this. We let Jesus be the one who intercedes for us. And we know this up here, but this story helps us feel it. We need to feel how important God's holiness is. Otherwise, though we recoil in terror with the Israelites, we'll come back the next day in support of the mutiny. This graphic, disturbing, and tragic story reminds us that we are not worshipping an insipid, powerless God. God is deadly serious about holiness and deadly serious about salvation. As Hebrews 12:26 says, "Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire." We will now express our confidence and ability to approach God in the words of the sons of Korah. In the songbooks, God is our strength and refuge.